And if you assume that all of us, each of us, is to a certain degree selfish at our core, simply because survival mechanism within us demands of us to be selfish, then maybe those political games that we observe being played are much simpler than they seem to be, and much less about what is being said, and much more about what is being exchanged in the background. Right. Or if something is on a discount, and you know, or at least you make a bet that it will be worth more into the future, then that is a potential trade that might bring you added value simply by taking part in it. Right. They are essentially companies and groups of people and people, individual traders as well, who are willing to go where no one else goes and deal with people that no one else would like to deal with. And so hello and welcome to WS Podcast. My name is Wojciech Salski, RBO Horse. Hello and welcome to WS Podcast. My name is Wojciech Salski, I'll be your host for today. And before we begin, may I just remind you, if you haven't already, please make sure to follow or subscribe, depending on your platform. If you think this is something, you know, worth your time, and if you're listening, then probably it is, then make sure to, you know, share it with a friend. Maybe suggest this episode to someone who would like to learn something about this book, or any other of the episodes and ideas and books that we've explored so far. And quite frankly, thank you so much for being here. You know, it's it means a lot, and it goes a long way. Thank you for all your emails and messages. I've actually received so many emails recently, and I have some really cool interviews lined up for you. And so I can actually feel more and more these days, just kind of, maybe a good way to put it would be to sort of reap what you sow, right? We've been working for quite some time. I've been running this show for almost 4 years now. And yeah, it means a lot. Maybe even over 4 years, I don't know. So thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for listening. And please don't hesitate to reach out if you'd like to support the podcast in any other way. Follow the link below. There are options there. You can buy me a coffee. I probably should get another one. Feeling slightly dazed by now. But yeah, here we are. Let's see. I have an interesting book for you. I've been postponing discussing this book for quite some time, and hopefully this is going to be a discussion worth your time. I've prepared some notes, I've marked the highlighted parts of the book that I'd like to share with you. Of course, as per usual, I'm not going to share the whole of the book, and I would encourage you to give it a read yourself. The book is called The World for Sale by Javier Blas and Jack Farchi. And this book was first published in 2021. So the sort of the story evidenced in this book, and basically the book is sort of structured in a way that tells the story of a few prominent figures in the space of commodity trading and history. And it goes all the way up to 2020 with its sort of historical account from the global finance and global trading, global markets, really, account, history. And it's written in a really reader-friendly way, because it actually discusses these topics in a sort of like a story form, which allows you to not only feel like you're learning, but also enjoy the process of kind of reading as if it was an action fiction novel, even though it's not really, you know, fiction. It certainly is action in many cases. So I will discuss some of the ideas, and I will focus on a lot of foundational, I think, knowledge that can be found in this book. And of course, I encourage you to give it a read. Probably, you know, if you can, if you want, you can listen to it as well. I can imagine it in an audiobook form to be quite a pleasurable experience as well. So it's definitely worth your time. I think this is the right season to discuss it. And since we've not so long ago, I think 3 weeks ago, had the discussion about the New Confessions of Economic Hitman, which was, of course, a book about how through financing and getting countries indebted, you can conquer a place. You will see some maybe some comparison with this book's story, and I'll show you some ideas. I'll share some of mine as well. And at the end of the day, if you would like it, then please read it and let me know if you do, because it means a lot for me if people actually do read. I believe we don't read enough these days, so I hope that you're one of the readers, and if you aren't, join us. Now, let's give it a start then. In terms of the first topic, first theme I'd like to discuss, it's the broader foundational theme of who are commodity traders and what does it mean. I know some of you might not be from a financial background, some of you might simply not be interested in this topic yet. I actually had a discussion with my wife yesterday about the fact that even though you're not interested in a topic, in a subject, from my perspective, it actually is quite beneficial for you to know a little bit about it, at least, simply not to be fooled and to fall prey to some snake oil salesman or, you know, some ideas or some propaganda. And so let's establish some ideas around, like, what does it mean to be a commodity trader? What do they do? So in terms of commodities, the way I understand it in layman's terms, is any sort of good, a resource, usually in physical form. We don't really trade commodities at the moment, which are not physical in substance and in their essence, I guess, is a good way to put it. And commodity trading can both be a simple trade of me coming, you know, to you with 10 kilograms of barley and you, you know, buying it off of me. And so that's the trade, the trade happened there. But also it can be arranging that trade to take place between two different parties as a third party, right? So I guess a good way to put it would be to be a middleman. And if you know anything about business, actually being that middleman can often be very sort of fruitful and at a low sort of cost of the actual activity. If you know a lot of people and you know how to satisfy their needs by connecting them to other people that could provide the service, you could potentially play the role of a middleman, right? Or a middlewoman, which essentially would be, let's say that I know a friend that makes great shoes, and I have a friend that would like to buy a great pair of personally made shoes. And so I arrange that trade to happen, and if the both parties agree, and if I'm, you know, maybe financially business savvy, I could potentially make a deal that, you know, 10% of what the person pays for those shoes goes to me, because I was the one that connected them and allowed that trade, you know, brought that trade to fruition, right? And so, of course, this is the a layer upon layer of the trade itself. You no longer have to be the only person selling or buying. You can also participate in that trade as the middle person connecting the two. And then there is a financialized, so I would say it's a layer three in this scenario situation, in which not only do you trade physically or trade by arranging one person's trade with another, but you play on the commodity trading market, right? And this is something that we'll explore later in the episode. But to begin with, this is essentially what you have if you have tried trading anything on any of those platforms out there, whether it's stocks, bonds, cryptocurrencies, commodities as well. You can trade essentially everything. I don't think there's many things that you cannot trade these days. I would be surprised if there is a egg trading on those platforms, because eggs are, you know, fairly fragile and they don't last long. But as long as it's a commodity that is likely to be used and transported across the world and is likely to last a bit longer than, you know, those few months, such as food, although you can also trade food as a commodity trader, you can trade them. And then at that level, we'll come back to later in the episode, I'll give you some just quotes from the book explaining essentially some aspects of trading, because I know this is, you know, this is not a financial show, and I'm just a an everyday man, but I think it's beneficial, especially in the day and age that many young people, and not only, are leaning towards trying out their efforts on the stock market, or maybe they want to start, you know, investing in some things. And it may seem really complicated, and at the first glance, it usually is. But as I've explained to you in the previous episodes, and we will be hammering this for another 4 or 5 episodes, I'm not sure where we are in the season cycle, I'll try to put forth to you the basics of these ideas, the way I understand them also, with some quotes, to ensure that you are not easily fooled, and at least you have some basic understanding of what someone might be offering you, or what might be advertised, you know, in your environment, wherever you are. Now, in terms of the three major participants in this story written by Blass and Farchi, there are three companies, and these are Glencore, which is a trader of metals mostly, Vitol, which is a trader of oil, and Cargill, which is the agricultural trading company. Now, a really cool quote here that I'll bring up straight away from Cargill, actually, which sort of sets the scene, I think, and we'll explore that in a second, is this one. The history of Cargill has been to go to places where other people want. That's where opportunity is. Whether there is a crisis or threat or things that are high risk, that means there is opportunity. That's the CEO of Cargill stating, you know, for the benefit of this book, what what are they all about. Now, let's lean into the basics of the basics, the foundations. Who are commodity traders in the words of the authors? Their influence is not limited to the economy. The commodity traders' control over the flow, the commodity traders' control over the flow of the world's strategic resources has also made them powerful political actors. They are the last swashbucklers of global capitalism, willing to do business where other companies don't dare set foot, thriving through a mixture of ruthlessness and personal charm. Many have traditionally viewed their superior access to information as a competitive edge, and so have gone to great lengths to avoid giving out any information about themselves. As Ian Taylor, who died in 2020, said as he sat down with us for an interview for this book, "We would prefer you not to write it." Now, you may ask, those are some random quotes. Basically, one quote says that they are potentially as powerful as politicians in this world. Second one points out that they are basically these ruthless and potentially charming individuals that do exercise the global capitalism idea. And then the third one is essentially just a brief underscore that some of them, if not all, would rather stay in the shadows and not be exposed with their work. To me, that sounds a hell of a lot like some sort of secret agent stuff. And in many ways, as you will explore in this book, it does feel like that. As the quote says at the very beginning, they are, and this ties into this idea of the middleman, they are essentially companies and groups of people and people, individual traders as well, who are willing to go where no one else goes and deal with people that no one else would like to deal with. And so they can take advantage of those opportunities, and they are low in risk aversion, and they are highly motivated to basically get the deal done, right? And I guess that's what the CEO of Cargill meant when he said that they are willing to go wherever the opportunity lies, no matter the consequences. Now, another quote here for you is, "The focus of this book is the companies and individuals whose business is buying and selling physical commodities. It is they who control the flow of natural resources around the world. It is in their hands that an almost unique type of political and economic power is concentrated. Our focus is on the companies and individuals whose main activity is neither producing nor consuming commodities, but trading them. These are the companies sometimes known as the independent traders or the trading houses." So, in terms of the trading, buying and selling, as you'll explore in the book, there are many, many, many instances where, by being so open to risk and so, let's say, unbounded by the social, political, ideological, norm, these guys and girls and essentially these businesses have been making the deals that could otherwise not have been made, essentially, by shaking the hands of those that no one else would shake hands with, and going to places where it seemed too difficult or too dangerous or too risky to try. And a prominent figure in the business, and I have a friend who's actually a commodity trader, and after reading this book, I sent him a voice note just like basically saying, "Oh my God, I understand now what you do, and it's crazy. Like, is this what you do?" And of course, like, he's not gonna, even if he did some crazy stuff, I don't think he would admit it over a voice note. But he did instantaneously mention a name, suggesting that I read a biography or, you know, I think, I'm pretty sure it's biography, not autobiography, of Mark Rich, who's one of the prominent sort of godfathers in some ways of the commodity trading businesses. And I laughed because obviously half of this book is dedicated to Glencore, Mark Rich, CEO, and the businesses that he was in, invested in and participating. And of course, it just shows that even in the commodity trading sphere, even right now, these guys still are considered and probably will be forever, or until commodity trading stops being a trading, which I don't think anytime soon, to be like the heroes or like the, you know, the godfathers of the whole industry. And you know, it just sort of proved to me, as I talked with my friend afterwards, that this book has something in it that is worth sharing with the world. I discussed at the time with him whether or not I should make a podcast about it, and he said that maybe I should wait for a season when it's a bit more entangled, not just out of the blue. And fair point, that was the idea of the season being a bit more about global economics and finance. But yeah, so I know for a fact from a commodity trader who is an active commodity trader that these guys were the real deal, and this is exactly how they did. We don't know how they do now, right? This is not the part of the book. Now, an important thing here that I wanted to sort of tie into what we've explored before, if you remember from, I don't know which episode it was, whether it was the Bitcoin episode or whether it was the Let's Talk About Money. I'll make sure to link all of the episodes that I do believe are relevant below, and you can check for yourself. But I'll reiterate, there is a saying, a quote someone said, and I don't want to, you know, butcher my guessing on who it was, but there is apparently this idea in terms of buying and selling on the market that the best moment to buy is when there is blood on the streets. And of course, this sounds a bit macabre and a bit rough, but the idea here, of course, is that if you remember from our previous episode, the Fear and Greed Index from the Psychology of Money episode from 2 weeks ago, the moment the market is the most fearful is the moment when it's at the greatest discount. And of course, this is not a set in stone rule. Like, if you might check the Fear and Greed Index and find that it's extremely fearful, and yet the price of something might not be as low as it could be. So don't quote me on this, and, you know, don't start making some trades just based on the index and not even looking at the chart or asking yourself what is it all about. This is not financial advice, it's just cool idea, really. But to tie it with this one, it seems to be an obvious dynamic that if you want to take advantage of any trade whatsoever, you would buy it at a lowest possible cost and try to sell it at the highest possible value, right? Highest possible price. It's the same case with anything. You can buy something from someone because it's broken. You can fix it, so you've added value to it, and then you can sell it off as something that is not broken for more. You can, at the same time, or similarly, buy a box of Lego now, and while it's still on the market, it's gonna keep a certain price, but we know that in a few years' time, Lego will stop producing that particular set, and so if you kept it untouched and new, in a few years' time, you're likely to be able to get more in dollar terms, pounds terms, whatever, for that set to sell it to another. And so you've speculated on the price here, right? You made a bet that in the future it will be worth more. So you take it now, you keep it, you store it, and then in the future you sell it, right? And I just wanted to mention it here because it's not only applicable to you, a retail investor, or to you, a person who's just trying to get by, to save some money, you know, to get your kids into school, to get yourself a better deal going forward, to maybe just bulletproof your pension or whatever. But it also applies to huge commodity traders and to the global market at large. All of these apply to everyone. That's just simply how the market works. And I think it's a great and empowering idea for us to reflect when we think about our little lives, that people in positions of power making trades for millions and trillions worth of, you know, dollars, pounds, whatever you want to use, still use the same idea, right? If something is on a discount and you know, or at least you make a bet that it will be worth more into the future, then that is a potential trade that might bring you added value simply by taking part in it, right? Now, let's get to our second sort of theme, which is the four global economy developments described in this book, right? And I'll just basically read out a few quotes and we'll explore some of them in a second. At the center of this book are four, at the center of this book's story are four developments which molded the global economy in the commodity trader's favor. The first was the opening up of markets that had previously been tightly controlled, above all, oil. The second was the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, which at a stroke redrew a global network of economic relationships and political allegiances. The third was the spectacular economic growth of China in the first decade of the century. The fourth was the financialization of the global economy and the growth of the banking sector beginning in the 1980s. And just to reiterate here, I've highlighted the trader's aim is to take a small profit margin on a large volume of trade. And that volume is truly enormous. In 2019, the four largest commodity traders had a turnover of $725 billion, more than the total exports of Japan. What's even more remarkable is that those profits have been shared among a very small group of people. They are usually quite small teams, if you can call them that. So, in the book, the stories told tie up these four impactful sort of global changes that have affected, and favorably so, the global commodity trading market. Opening of different markets, which is, you know, oil among many, collapse of the Soviet Union, China's exponential growth, and financialization of the economy and banking. Now, for, I guess, before we go any further, maybe just ask yourself briefly, how much do you know about any of these? If you're like myself and were brought up in a country which sort of participated in the collapse of the Soviet Union, even if you were not there to see it, you're likely to know something about that period. Of course, what you know might not be exactly what happened. You know, history is a very difficult topic to address without affecting it by the perspective we take. But depending on where you're from, you know, I know a majority of my listeners, a majority of you, my dear audience, are from the United States and from the UK. So for you, especially for those in the United States, I bet your parents remember quite clearly the Iraq War and the, you know, the oil-related activities that happened during that time, and your parents can probably bring back, or at least their parents and your parents through your grandparents can bring back the story of taking the dollar off the gold standard by Nixon in 1971. So these are the, or maybe 1970. No, I think it's one. Anyway, don't quote me on this. Check it. I don't remember exactly the dates all the time. Depending on where you're from, some of these might sound more like something you can relate to, and some less. You know, for me, one that has definitely influenced my understanding of the world was actually the interlinked, sort of intertwined collapse of the Soviet Union and China's growth as a manufacturing base of the world. And of course, we are all benefiting from China's manufacturing over the past decades. One could argue whether or not we're benefiting on all fronts. You know, this is not the part of this episode. And I don't feel like I should be the one discerning and deciding on those things and casting stones of judgment. But for me personally, I was brought up in a country, in a post-Soviet country, which my parents remember the revaluation of our currency. They remember the time when one would have to stand in queue outside the shop. The shop was usually empty. Unless you knew the shopkeeper, you were unlikely to get any good, you know, quality products. And the products that were there, you not only had to pay for them in money, you actually had to also have a piece of paper stating that you can buy them. This was what the Soviet regime, introduced as a way of rationing, obviously, the dwindling, supply of whatever they haven't had. So it was a huge shock for, on a positive front for sure, for my parents, to live through the time when standing in queues outside the shop and, you know, trying to be there early on, sometimes hours before it would open, to make sure to get that piece of bread, to get that toilet paper, which was a huge luxury, and this is no joke. Like, I'm pretty sure we sort of experimented with that a little bit during COVID, when people panicked and toilet paper was one of the things that suddenly it turns out everyone needed. But it's no joke. Like, you can look up photos of people from Poland during the Soviet times, literally carrying toilet rolls as a bandolier across their body, as because that's how you would buy them. Per, you'd buy one roll each, and you would just string them along and carry them like some sort of, you know, it was just a way of transporting them, but of course it also looked quite peculiar. Check it out, it's real. So imagine the shock you experience when you live through those times, and then the 90s roll around, suddenly the regime collapses, you have somewhat of a democratic state forming, and suddenly your country is opened for business with other countries, and your market, your shops, your country, your, you know, your city becomes flooded with all these options. And this is what this is the time when I came to be. And, you know, my parents remember times when it was really difficult to buy any toys whatsoever. I remember a time, like any other, when shops were full of toys, right? We had all of the Western movies and food and, you know, items suddenly at our doorstep, right? My mom used to, every now and then, one of their family member would travel abroad for some reason, or, you know, if you were lucky enough to have someone living in the United States during the Soviet-Russian time in Poland. And then potentially that American uncle, let's say, would send you actual pair of jeans. And of course, for all of your, all of you Americans out there, that was probably not a big deal in the 80s. But for an average Polish person, getting a real pair of jeans from United States was a huge deal. And they were worth a lot of money. And of course, much of it was paid in dollars at the time, simply because it was a much stronger currency than devalued Polish złoty, or whatever they had at the time. I'm pretty sure it was still called złoty. So imagine the difference, right? And then obviously I come around the 90s and 2000s, and the abundance rolls in. And at a very similar time, slightly later, China becomes a market open for business with the whole world. And China's capacity to produce, to mass produce at a lower rate of cost, made everything suddenly much cheaper, right? And yet again, this is something we've all benefited from. Even if you consider this to be a net negative to the planet or a net negative to your country or whatever, there is no doubt that by allowing a powerful production force to enter the market and sell their products, it definitely allowed you as an average Joe and Jane to use and consume products that were much cheaper, maybe not as good, but certainly cheaper and more approachable in, you know, in their pricing, most importantly, on the daily basis, right? So these are not trends, and these are not stories that are out there not touching us. These are things like this episode and many of the others we've been discussing recently. These are things that touch and affect us every day. The price of oil going up will affect the price of your groceries. The price of oil going down will affect the price of your groceries. It's all interconnected, and the global market is, in our day and age, really, really connected to our market. Of course, unless you're living in a state which is completely isolating itself from other markets, such as maybe North Korea. But in many countries, including the ones you're likely to listen from, all of these movements in commodity trading and finance and global politics, all of this will somehow impact your life. And so, personally, I believe it's worth exploring these topics, even just on the surface, to be able to understand the mechanics behind them, or at least to understand how they can affect you. And so how can you, you know, prepare yourself and be better of it, be better because of it, or if you don't, you might get hurt. And this is yet again straight into my mind the quote from Ray Dalio saying, if you do worry, you do not have to worry. If you don't worry, you do have to worry, right? We should, and I would encourage you to do your due diligence and sort of read deeper than just the headlines, to be able to discern what's going on and understand and apply some skillful decision making to make sure that you and your family and your close circle of friends and maybe someone else benefit from it. And here I just wanted to bring up the book by Nassim Taleb, which we've discussed I think a year or two back, called The Black Swan. And if you remember, the black swan in economy and in sort of macroeconomy is this unexpected event, right? The example here is people thought that there are always black swans, that there are always white swans. So they assumed, it was assumed and expected that there every swan is a white swan. And then one time a gentleman, I think, traveled to Australia or something and found a black swan. And that's where the origin of this term comes from, which is just because it was that way all of the time doesn't mean it will be that way all of the time, right? Just because I know 20 people that are named Joe, I should not extrapolate and assume that every person in the world is called Joe, right? And the black swan event is something that takes place in the world, whether it's a, you know, a crisis or some sort of a shift in culture, or maybe some you know, catastrophe that shakes us, or some invention that happens, whatever it is, that couldn't have been predicted, because it before it occurred, it was a part of that unknown space, right? So we have the known known, which is all you know right now, for sure. You have the known unknown, which are the uncertainties that you can sort of predict. For example, you know that the bus is coming tomorrow in the morning to take you to work, but it's a known unknown whether or not maybe the bus will be late. And the unknown is whether or not the bus will be late, but you know of that unknown. And then the unknown unknown is the black swan event of, you've never thought that a bus will suddenly disappear right in front of you, right there in front of you. And you simply don't take it into account. You walk up to the bus one day, and then as the door opens, the bus disappears. And that would be a very silly example of black swan event taking place in your daily. So I just wanted to point out here that many of the things that are mentioned in the book and the events that happen and are happening at all times really in the world will be a part of that known unknown and unknown unknown. Even though maybe someone knew about it, for us, everyday participants of the market, but not necessarily movers of it, they might be those black swans. And the whole theory about educating yourself on how to look at macroeconomics and how to look at personal finance and how to look at your health and everything can be applied to at least narrow down the potential of you getting yourself hurt or falling into some sort of trouble because of this unknown unknown that might occur. So yeah, little rant there for you, but I would definitely encourage you to explore that episode, The Black Swan, and apply these ideas to your daily life and educate yourself about them. Now, the third topic that I'd like to explore, because I don't want to dive too deep into these four global economy developments, is the question that I've posed for myself, but I'm going to ask you first. Is there any politics at all, or is it all just business? What do you think? What does your gut or your heart tell you? I'm going to drink some water and you can consider it. is there any politic? Is there any actual politics at all? Is there any ideology at all? Or do you think that at a foundational level, it's all just business? Just ideas being traded, commodities being traded, money flowing there and from influence and power. Well, I'm not going to give you the answer. I will give you the answer from the claims from the book, and I'll explore why that might be. But personally, I'm in two minds about it. I think there is a layer to it that might be slightly more on the political. But for the most part, it seems to me, and certainly that's what the authors underscore and highlight, that I've highlighted, is that you should always, in any case, if you're trying to understand what's going on in the world, follow the money, right? This is a very popular hashtag and sort of quote, meme even, in the circles of people that are a bit more skeptical about what governments of our world want to do, and all the good doers try to do, apart from their claims, what they try to do, is that if you want to learn the truth, just follow the money, right? The money is where you'll find the truth, right? So let's explore some of the ideas that are related to this, and I'll discuss with you in a second some of these. As one of Philip Brothers' early traders put it, and Philip Brothers was one of the major company at the time, commodity trading company, one of the basic rules of Philip Brothers is that business is supreme. Political matters are not business. Political matters are not business, according to them. The savviest traders used global networks of contacts to gain unparalleled insights into the state of the world economy. With this sophisticated network of market intelligence came a culture of secrecy, as the traders sought to protect their insights. It was a neat distillation of the strategy that the early traders had pioneered. Build a large portfolio of contracts as possible. Build as large a portfolio of contracts as possible. Squeeze your network of contacts for information, and then exploit that information to trade profitably. While the early trading houses had different origins and different styles, they shared an emphasis on hard work, loyalty, and partnership. And here there is just a mention that in 1956, the company, Philip Brothers, distributed shares to about 40 of its employees, creating several millionaires in the process. Just to underscore how small these teams have been. So let's stop here for a moment and just focus on these three, right? So hard work, loyalty, and partnership. And there was a mention that it's all about business. Politics is not business. And that they would make connections with people around the world. They would set some contracts with businesses around the world, production businesses and consumption businesses. And then they would tie these two together to make the most of their trades and potential, you know, to play the market, right? In many ways, they became, through that, market makers, right? Because if you think about it, if I manage to control a substantial percentage of, let's say, apple supply in your city, then through a coordinated action of maybe, you know, a story could be, I get one of my contacts to announce that apples are really, really healthy for you right now and everyone should eat 5 apples a day. And at the same time, I've cornered the market, quote unquote, cornered, to ensure that I have the major, you know, majority of the supply of apples. I could then make that speculation bet of first, and we'll come back to that in a second, shorting the apples position, as basically say, you know, stating on the market that there won't be enough apples on the market to meet the needs of the city. And then as that supply shock happens, because it turns out I control all the apples and I simply don't want to sell them, the value and the price value of an apple will go up on the market because everyone wants the apple and no one can get it. And then I flood the market with my apples and earn on that front as well, right? So by being able to provide the service or, you know, the, in this case, commodities, and stop that provision as well, and at the same time, by the ability with my connected network, you know, managers and all that, to manipulate the situation on the market, I could really take advantage of it all. And this is something that, this is a theme that over time becomes very reminiscent of the game Monopoly. If you've ever played this most frustrating of games, and personally, I think that game is quite stupid, to put it bluntly. I don't think there is much to it apart from Monopoly, right? It's about how monopolies are formed, literally. So if you've played the game at least once, you know, unless you've not finished the game, that over time, simply by luck, one person will end up with all or the majority of the market and everyone else will end up broke, right? It's a zero-sum game. There can only be one winner and other losers. There is no way in playing that game and winning it without destroying everyone else, essentially, right? But it just so happens in markets, and especially in markets that are not completely free, but of course free markets also can have that case taking place, that over time big players tend to amass greater influence, and therefore sort of like a flywheel effect impact their position to play bigger and therefore amass a bigger gain. And throughout the book, the theme is presented where some of these trading houses end up using their acquired capital to acquire, to take out or to buy out, or literally to manipulate the market, you know, basically bring to its knees a competitor and then buy them out. And they end up monopolizing the resources that they're trading. And then the game becomes more and more in their favor, right? This is the part when the middleman stops being the middleman, really. If you're both the middleman and the person who's actually producing, then you're not really a middleman. Of course, on paper you might still be, but effectively you're rendered the producer. You just try to play both fronts. And of course, you will have an advantage because you not only produce, and so you can earn, you can gain from selling it, but you can also manipulate the supply factor of the economy and therefore actually speculate on the price, right? And now let's go into that speculation before we sort of come back to these qualities of hard work, loyalty and partnership. Okay, yeah. All right, so I'll switch it around a little bit. Sorry for that, but I jumped the gun. I'll read you two more quotes on the topic of is there any politics or is it just business? And then I'll bring up the speculation part. Deus is basically one of the companies that produces oil. And it says here, for him, money was a proxy for political influence. When asked why money was so important to him, he replied, "Don't you understand that it's a question of power? And money means power. It's as simple as that." So that was, I believe, is one of the traders. Sorry, I thought it's a company. Now, the bribes were paid in order to be able to do business, Mark Rich told his biographer. It's not a price which is disadvantageous for the government involved in the selling or buying. He saw nothing wrong with paying for access. While the US had introduced anti-corruption laws, some European nations hadn't. In Switzerland, it was even possible to account for the facilitation fees, as the bribes were often called in corporate speak, as tax-deductible expenses. Of course, you know, this is not to discuss the morality of the thing. It's just to state the obvious from the book that bribing someone, so either by offering favors or favorable terms or simply some gifts or actual financial gain, commodity traders at the time, I'm not saying it's happening right now, were able to take advantage of the situation, right? It was a way of gaining the person's trust, influence, you know, being offered the opportunity that you wouldn't get otherwise. And for them, in some cases, it was actually a tax deductible, right? If you're running if any of you is running a business, or maybe even if you're self-employed, for example, in the UK, as a self-employed person, you can deduct some of your expenses as a tax deductible because they form a base, you know, a part of your cost base for your services. Let's say that you're don't quote me on this, but the way I understand it is, let's say that you are a creative writer and one of your expenses that you have to incur as part of your work is notebooks. And so you can keep the documentation saying that you've purchased that many notebooks in the year. And when the time comes for tax filling, you can state that you've expensed these as part of your taxable deductible, sort of. Now, of course, it sounds quite outrageous that a bribe could be tax deductible. According to the authors, that's what was the case at the time. If you want to look up how it is right now, I don't, you know, check it out. I'm not sure. But just to reiterate then and sort of close this topic, ask yourself again, is there any politics, is there any other game than the game of power and money? Is there any other game than the game of business? And I think this is really, really important for us to observe, especially in our day and age, simply because we are living through really curious, some might say tumultuous, and maybe some worrisome times. And it's very easy to, you know, watch some newscast or read an article on the internet and assume that this particular propaganda, this particular ideology, this particular, noble idea is the reason behind people, companies, countries acting. I dare you to sort of assume that there also could be another motive, which is much simpler, much less noble, much less moral in a sense of even considering what morality might be. And that's simply the gain of influence, the gain of power, or the gain of finance, the gain of resources. And if you assume that no man is better than their incentives, and this is definitely a sentence for you to ponder, no man is better than his incentives. If you assume that, and if you assume that all of us, each of us, is to a certain degree selfish at our core, simply because survival mechanism within us demands of us to be selfish, then maybe those political games that we observe being played are much simpler than they seem to be, and much less about what is being said, and much more about what is being exchanged in the background, or what resources, you know, and some sort of items or finance or influences are being traded as part of these different dynamics. A really interesting podcast that I'll link below, and this is not for those faint of heart, and you know, explore it at your own peril, but it's the Simon Dixon Heart Talk show, which is on YouTube. I'm not sure if he still produces on Spotify. He's definitely on YouTube though, so I'll link the YouTube one. This is a gentleman that personally, I think his perspective is certainly quite bleak, and not too assuring, but it's also very down to earth, follow the money analysis that he's doing. And I dare you, if this episode is something that you've been enjoying so far and you consider this to be an important topic for you to explore further, Simon Dixon's podcast is actually one of those ones that I would recommend diving into. And good luck with that. I hope you'll have at least a little bit of fun. Now, the final big quote, actually, that I would like to read is also the one that I'd like you to basically pay attention to in terms of technical terms, right? So unless you have someone working in finance in your family, or unless you are interested in finance like myself, you probably have not ever had a chance to hear or to learn about these ideas. And I think this is important purely educationally for you to know if someone ever offers you a certain deal such as this one, or mentions those things, for you to at least know the basics, to kind of get the glimpse of what these financial markets offer, right? And how speculative and I think somewhat crazy they can be. And of course, this is a part of the book, the fourth part, which is the financialization of the economy and banking playing greater and greater role in the trading. With new financial instruments at their disposal, they opened the market to an array of new participants who had no intention of ever seeing a barrel of actual crude oil, and instead were happy to buy and sell notional quantities of what were soon dubbed paper barrels. That's where futures, options, and other similar financial products came in. In reality, there was very little new about them. Copper and tin traders had been buying and selling futures on the London Metal Exchange for a century. So had grain traders on the Chicago Board of Trade and elsewhere. Rice brokers in Japan had been trading futures since as early as 1697, starting what is believed to be the world's first futures exchange. For oil, though, no such market existed until the 1980s. A commodity futures contract is, as its name suggests, a contract for delivery of a commodity at some point in the future. The creation of futures markets opened a new range of possibilities for oil traders. They were no longer restricted to buying and selling oil on the spot, but could also buy and sell oil for delivery in a few weeks, months, or years. Anyone who buys a futures contract and holds it until its expiry will receive a parcel of commodities. On the other hand, someone who sells a future contract must, at expiry, deliver the commodities. Once the oil futures market came into being, traders could use futures contracts to buy or sell their oil many months in advance, but the usage of the new instruments was much broader than that. Most people didn't hold them until expiry. Instead, they bought and sold futures much as they would buy and sell the barrels of oil themselves. The futures allowed traders and anyone else to bet on the direction of the market without having to touch a physical barrel of oil, hence the talk about paper barrels. If the price of oil went down, the value of the future contracts the trader had sold would also go down, and the trader would be able to buy them back at a lower price. If the price of oil went up, the trader would lose money on the futures contract, but make the same amount of money on the increased value of the physical cargo of oil. Either way, the use of the futures market allowed the trader to lock in the price of oil, reducing risk. Options offered even more flexibility. For a fee, a premium, they gave a trader the choice but not the obligation to buy or sell a futures contract at a predetermined price and time. Together, futures and options are called derivatives because their value derives from that of an underlying commodity. Now, that's a lot, I know, but the gist of it, futures and options, right? Futures are contracts to either buy or sell a commodity at a certain point into the future, at a certain price, or not. And then options is also an option to... So an option is like a future with an option whether or not you actually want to do it, right? So, you know, of course, these are very technical, and I appreciate that I might have lost some of you there. But now you know, if anyone ever mentions to you that they trade futures, you know that what they're doing is they're speculating on the price of something into the future. If they say that they trade options, you know that what they do is they speculate on the price into the future with an option to act or not upon it. Of course, there is also another layer to it, which is leveraging, which is basically betting on steroids, because what you could do, and I definitely not recommend it, and I actually stressed it quite clearly in the why you shouldn't buy Bitcoin episode. There is an option on the market to leverage your position, which basically means, for example, I bet £10 on the future, but then I take a loan effectively from the market maker, from the exchange, let's say, from the app or whatever, from the bank with whom I'm trading these futures. I take a loan for £100, right? So even though I'm only playing with £10 of my own, if I win, of course, I get a multiplier of what mine plus the money from the bank would bring me. So let's say if there is a 5x multiplier from my bet of £110, if I were successful, I would earn £550 worth, and then I would pay back the bank the £100 and get off with whatever is left. But it, you know, it's a double-edged sword that if I lose, now I not only lose what I've bet, but I also lose what I've borrowed, right? And this is where it becomes a very slippery slope. And personally, I don't play those games. I think it's a very scary idea. I'm, as I mentioned to you before, I'm quite a fearful person and I'm quite a greedy person. And knowing yourself to be that is probably a good thing, because I'm not inclined to, I mean, I'm inclined to do them. I just don't do them because I think I know and I think that it's not going to be good for me, because simply I'm just going to act on my emotions. But yeah, that's another kettle of fish for you. So here we are. I appreciate a very different episode and I hope you enjoyed it. My invitation for you for this week is to ponder these questions that we've asked ourselves, you know, to ponder, is there any politics or is it all just business? To maybe stop yourself in your track. If you are at some point in, you know, throughout the week, if you are in a situation where some news happen, some political news or whatever, and your emotional response is to, you know, observe it from the standpoint of like ideology or morality or whatever, the goodness of someone's heart, stop yourself and ask yourself, you know, maybe research, where does the money come from for that thing? If someone is funding some war somewhere, where does the money come from? Who is the one funding and where does the money go? Maybe there is some business to be made in that particular skirmish, you know? Maybe not. I don't know. If someone's voting for something, or someone is, you know, proposing for you some great new solution to your problem, follow the money. Ask yourself, what do they want? Is there anything that they will gain from it? Maybe there is something that you will have to give in return and they just don't focus on that part, and that's just the small print, right? So just at work, in my audit work, we have this behavioral, you know, rules, whatever, and one of them is to stay professionally skeptical, right? You should showcase your professional skepticism when you're going through financials of a company, when you're, conducting the audit. And I am challenging you, my dear friend, to be personally skeptical, professionally skeptical and personally skeptical. And just ask yourself and don't be afraid to doubt, and sort of dig a little bit deeper into those and try to understand, where does the money come from? Where does it go? Where's the flow there? And I think you'll be better off for it, if even just because you will be a bit more informed, or your mind will be opened slightly more. Other than that, before you go, please smash that like button and that subscribe button. You know, I can't stress it enough. It really, really helps. If you haven't already, please do. I promise I will not be spamming. The episodes are coming out every week, and rarely do I ever make unexpected episode outside of that cycle. So you will not be bombarded with spam episodes. All of it, I'm doing all I can to make it a curated and a quality experience for you and for myself. And please do. For all of you out there who are listening and have subscribed and are participating in this adventure of mine, thank you very much. I look forward to sharing with you in the coming weeks what's going on, because I will be switching the platform and there's going to be some exciting developments happening. But for the time being, have a wonderful, wonderful week. Stay happy, stay healthy, and I'll see you next time.